You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, or CHOGM as it's called. It's coming up next week. While the opening ceremony is due on the 15th of November, it's going to be preceded by other fora, including a youth forum on the 10th and a business forum on the 12th. Now, CHOGM has been for years dogged by questions of relevance. This time, the question of CHOGM's relevance is tied to the suitability of the country hosting the meeting. And the host is none other than the Democratic Socialist Republic of Sri Lanka. I spoke to Ruki Fernando. He is a Sri Lankan activist with an NGO called Inform Human Rights and Documentation Center. I asked him about this campaign, a two-year-long campaign around CHOGM and its choice of Sri Lanka as host and chair of the Commonwealth.
The campaign was about two things. One was about Sri Lanka. One was more broadly about the Commonwealth itself as an organization. And our point of departure was that the Commonwealth is a value-based organization, which values separation of powers between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislation, which recognizes human rights as a cornerstone of its existence, which values media freedom and rule of law. So 2 years ago, we felt that it is, if it's going to be held, the heads of government meeting should be in a place that values and which clearly indicates that it values these basic fundamental principles and values that the Commonwealth has said that it subscribes to. And also that the leadership of the Commonwealth should be held by a state that very clearly values and abides by these principles and
by having it in Sri Lanka, does Sri Lanka then assume the chair of the Commonwealth Heads of Government?
That's been the tradition so far, that the country that hosts the Heads of Government meeting becomes the head of the Commonwealth for 2 years. So at the beginning of the campaign, our campaign was not about not having the CHOGM in Sri Lanka. It was about making sure that if CHOGM is going to be held in Sri Lanka, that Sri Lanka abides by these fundamental values and principles that the Commonwealth is based on.
What was happening 2 years ago that made you and the groups in Sri Lanka concerned? Or was there, or were there signals that the country was veering away from these principles?
Yes, in 2011, there were very clear signals that Sri Lanka had already veered off many of these standards, the benchmarks, principles and values that the Commonwealth has claimed it adheres to. For example, there has been no accountability for allegations, very serious allegations of war crimes that were committed by the government of Sri Lanka as well as the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, particularly during the last phase of the war. There has also been absolute impunity for a number of other extrajudicial executions, thousands of enforced disappearances, attacks on journalists and media institutions, lawyers, human rights activists, and so forth. So we felt at that moment, that in 2011, that Sri Lanka was not the most appropriate place to have the CHOGM or to lead the Commonwealth. But we thought, or we were hopeful, that 2 years later, Sri Lanka would be able to reform itself and bring it to a position or a stage where it would be worthy of hosting the CHOGM assuming the leadership of the Commonwealth as well.
And in that respect, how successful was the campaign?
Well, the Sri Lankan government has steadfastly refused to abide by the values and the principles of the Commonwealth. I think one of the most prominent example was when the Chief Justice was impeached. In Sri Lanka, the views of the Supreme Court cannot be challenged by any other institution or body. The Supreme Court and the highest courts in Sri Lanka has ruled that impeachment process was invalid, was unconstitutional, but the parliament decided to go ahead with it, totally ignoring. So that indicated that there was no recognition, there was no respect for the principle of separation of powers between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislation. And we've also come to a stage where one family totally dominates the whole country's governance. So we have a very powerful executive president. We have a brother of him who is the secretary to the Ministry of Defense, who is also extremely powerful, far more powerful than any other secretary to any ministry. We have another brother who is the Minister of Economic Development. We have another brother who is the speaker in the parliament. And the president actually makes appointments, like the Chief Justice, to the Human Rights Commission and to all the commissions that are supposed to be independent oversight bodies. So there is no system of check and balances in Sri Lanka at the moment. There is no system of rule of law. What we have is a rule of one family.
Was this family popularly elected?
Yes, the president was popularly elected. So was the brothers, except, of course, the defense secretary, who is supposed to be a public official and who was appointed. But the popular vote does not always reflect the total aspirations of all the people, particularly because Sri Lanka is a very diverse country and we have minority groups, both religious and ethnic. The war in Sri Lanka was all about the ethnic minorities. So just because someone was popularly elected by the majority ethnic group or the majority religious group does not mean that they should be able to do anything that they want to do. I think the whole system of democracy is based on respect for minorities and people who are marginalized, and also is respect for dissent and people who disagree with the existing regime. And I think on both these counts, Sri Lanka has failed miserably. Respect for minorities and respect for and appreciation, tolerance of dissent.
The Canadian Prime Minister is not coming. Why?
Well, the Canadian Prime Minister has said that he can't go to a country that does not abide by the Commonwealth values and fundamental human rights standards. And I think that's very, very valid. And that's the position that I would take. And that's the position that many of my colleagues, human rights defenders and human rights organizations in Sri Lanka and outside Sri Lanka have taken.
What has been the response of the Sri Lankan government to the decision by Canada?
The Sri Lankan government has been very unhappy about the decision of the Canadian government, the Canadian Prime Minister, not to come. But I think they don't seem to care about what the international community actually says.
What do you expect will happen now that the meeting is going to go ahead? Mm-hmm. Is there anything that human rights defenders and civil society can hope for from this meeting in terms of their own aspirations or concerns about the situation in Sri Lanka?
Well, I think what victims of human rights violations, people affected by violence and war, human rights defenders would expect is that these people who come, the heads of governments who actually come, would express very forthright views privately, but as well as publicly, about what they think and feel. We expect that they would also spend time to meet and listen to people who have been affected by the war and violence, victims of human rights violations, like families of disappeared people, like people whose land is presently occupied by the military. And we hope that they will engage in some at least symbolic actions of showing solidarity with these people who are suffering, who are longing for truth, justice.
Do you think the Commonwealth as an organization remains relevant?
Well, I think in the past, the Commonwealth has taken some strong positions in relation to countries like Pakistan, Fiji. But I think having the Commonwealth heads of government in Sri Lanka, and if they allow Sri Lanka to actually assume the leadership, will make the Commonwealth irrelevant in terms of the values it says it wants to uphold.
So that was Ruki Fernando. It's often noted that Sri Lanka's decades-long civil war ended in 2009. But have the underlying causes of the conflict been resolved? I asked Ruki, what is at the heart of the Sri Lankan conflict?
Sri Lanka has always been seen by the Sinhalese and the Buddhists as their country, and that the Christians and the Hindus and the Muslims or anyone else are visitors who can be tolerated and who can be allowed to live, but not have the same rights. So it's, I think, that perception that still dominates. And unfortunately, the state backs that perception of this Sri Lanka being a Sinhalese Buddhist country. So as long as that state backing is there, I think this is likely to continue and it's going to be very difficult to challenge that. And the more extremist groups within the Buddhist community, within the Sinhalese community, are strengthened by the backing they receive from the state. And this is reflected in the impunity that we see. For example, we have police officers watching by Buddhist monks and mobs led by Buddhist monks physically attacking and destroying Muslim establishments and Christian churches. And they don't do anything about it. And there's absolute impunity. Nothing happens afterwards. So that's an indicator of how much state support there is for this Sinhalese Buddhist domination.
That was Ruki Fernando, an activist with the NGO Inform Human Rights and Documentation Centre, speaking on the eve of the Commonwealth Head of Government's meeting in Sri Lanka. I'm Sharad Kutan for BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.